Welcome to Cider Chat. It's part six of the Building a Cidery series with Aris Brewery and Cider House based in Chicago, Illinois.
Going up.
Hello, my name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks in the cider trade from around the world. For those listeners who are just tuning into Cider Chat for the first time, just to give you a little perspective, this is the sixth season of this weekly podcast, and there are over 250 episodes. This episode this week is 260, so maybe I need to update that a little bit. It just keeps on climbing, and I'm on a streak here. I can't stop because there's a lot going on in the cider sphere on every single shore, it seems, worldwide. There's been makers from nearly, I think about 20 countries now, and nearly every state in the United States. Myself, I'm based on the East Coast of the U.S. in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and I also happen to live in a very special spot in the Commonwealth known as Franklin County. It is here where modern cider in the U.S. really started. After many, many years of stagnation, the first commercial cidery to get underway took place here in Franklin County. And wouldn't you know it, for this kind of like Valentine's Day season, I received a little letter from someone that I really qualify as the person in the U.S. who helped light that fire under so many people's, well, fill in the blank, to get cider going and to be noticed. And it wasn't easy back in 1984. I mean, folks, you know, just thought of cider as one in New England as just sweet apple juice, just fresh pressed. But this gal really took the banner, and she's amazing. She's just absolutely amazing. One, because I have the pleasure of sitting on the committee with her for Franklin County Cider Days, which is the oldest cider festival in the U.S. of A. And every time we're getting a little bit, might I say, technical, clinical kind of way of talking about cider, she'll say something that just stops me in my tracks. Actually, often, more often than not, takes my breath away. And it happened very recently at a meeting that we had for the Franklin County Cider Days committee. We're all getting technical, reviewing how the last season went with the Cider Trail. How many people are going to the like different events? Did we hear from the producers? What's the feedback? Do we have numbers? You know, data, marketing, kind of like a scarcity mentality, to tell you the truth. And she said something that, once again, took my breath away, and it was essentially that it was a time to just be comforted through apples. And I thought, yeah, comforted through apples. And she said, comfort me through apples. I'm like, hello, that's what this is all about. I mean, that was exactly what we all needed in the fall, to be comforted through apples, you know, to have a reason to keep on going out each day, to see people, to be happy. And there's really nobody who says it better than her. So that just floors me. And I try to write down these little idioms that she says, because it holds me going forward. So who is this woman? And why is she so intrinsic to American cider making, and I think really kind of creating the bell ring that was heard around the world? Well, that is none other than Judith Maloney of West County Cider, the first commercial cidery in the U.S. in 1984, at a time when nobody was talking about it. And truthfully, for anyone listening out there right now who is a commercial maker, especially in the U.S., I truly believe that you would be in a spot like where cider was 10 years ago right now than where you are today. You wouldn't really maybe even know about it. Who knows? Because if it wasn't for this lady pounding the pavement, knocking on doors, trying to convince people that cider was viable, being the first cidery to be written up in the New York Times at a time when nobody even was thinking about it here in the U.S. It was kind of like put under the sheath, so to speak. We wouldn't be here today. So I received this letter just this weekend, just in time for Valentine's Day, from Judith. And I opened up the card, and she drew with crayon four hearts on top of this card, which has like a bench with flowers on it. So there's these four red hearts. I'm like, oh, what is this? You know, from Judith. I opened up this blank card inside. She drew another big heart with an exclamation point and wrote, "Rhea, I appreciate your vision for cider," and signed it Judith Field, and then put in parentheses Terry. I need to take a little pause here. If you don't know by now, Terry Maloney, we lost back in 2010 to an industrial accident during the making of cider. He and Judith, along with their young son at the time, back in 1984, were, as I said, you know, the first pioneers of U.S. cider. And of course, it was a huge and tragic loss for the Maloneys, Terry's passing. But it was also a huge loss for U.S. cider. And I often am left wondering, what would be the message of cider today if Terry was still here as that leader in the industry that he was, and having that power couple that was so unpretentious, so not about just the market of cider, but all the people, comforting people through the love of apples. Now, that is a missing piece that I'm not always hearing it being resonated at that level, but true to their messaging and to knowing them and role modeling it to me, I hope I get to deliver that to you each week on Cider Chat. So tip of the glass to Judith Maloney for taking the time to reach out to me to be a listener of Cider Chat, and to boot, she sent a donation in that letter. It just absolutely floors me. And feeling grateful about all the comfort that we do feel through our love and joy of apples.
Walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
It's time now for our Q&A with Fermentis. And this week we'll once again be hearing from Kevin as he answers the following question. I thought there were nutrients already in apples. Do you need nutrients when making cider? And if so, what kind? Take it away, Kevin.
Hello, my name is Kevin Lane, and I'm the Technical Sales Support Manager for the Americas for Fermentis. This is a very good question, and it's a question that Fermentis is currently working on, coming out with an exact answer to what should or what should not be used. Apple cider, apple juice does have nutrients present. However, for a fermentation, for yeast growth, for the alcoholic fermentation, for flavor profile and flavor production, the yeast do need some additional nutrients. Of course, you could make a cider without adding nutrients. It's just that the apple juice or must is going to be deficient in some things. So it might not be a perfect fermentation. It might not happen in the same time period as you would expect. And there could be some different flavor productions based on that deficiency in certain micronutrients or even nitrogen or other compounds that the yeast really need for a healthy growth and healthy fermentation. In terms of what Fermentis recommends to use, at this point in time, we're doing some research into applying different types of nutrient to the fermentations. From our experience in the wine industry that we've had a longer experience in, we found that there are certain things that you can apply that will help both the start of fermentation and the completion of fermentation. From Fermentis currently, all that we have right now that's available is our wine portfolio. And those are products that are called Spring Firm, Spring Firm Extreme, Vinny Liquid, which is a liquid nutrient that can be added to fermentation. But really, it's a portfolio of more or less nutrients that have been used in wine that we know can play a similar role in the fermentation of apple cider or apple juice. So I know that we're investigating it further. At this point, we don't have necessarily a specific cider nutrient program set up, but I know that we're doing research into it and we're trying to identify what is the best process for giving the nutrient needed and applying it to the fermentation.
Thanks, Kevin. And if you'd like to find out more, just go to fermentis.com. It's part 6 of the Building a Cidery series. In part 1 and 2 of the series, we began with trademark law, what it is, and how to secure a trademark for your business. In part 3, we heard from the makers at Courthouse Creek Cider House, based in Virginia. At Courthouse Creek, their fermentations are all done in oak barrels. In part 4 of the series, we spoke to Steve Garwood at Ragged Hill Cidery, based in West Brookfield, Massachusetts. At Ragged Hill, they primarily ferment in stainless steel, though they do have a barrel program too. So both cideries, both orchard-based. In part 5 of this series, which was last week's episode 259, we spoke with Soham Bhatt of Artifact Cider Project, based in two locations, one in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and one in Florence, Massachusetts, which is out nearby me. So yay for me. In that cidery, you could consider it a modern production facility where they are not orchard-based. They're sourcing their juice from local orchards. In this episode, part 6, we are talking with a woman-owned modern cidery that has both beer and cider being made at the same location. And to top it off, it is also a full-service restaurant. On the basement floor is a cidery. They had to, at the time, open up the windows at the ground level and move the cidery in. And you'll hear a bit about that. Then on the first floor is the brewery. It's a 30-barrel brew house and the restaurant. There are plans on the second floor for a 200-person event space. And outside, there is seating, which is perfect for this COVID time, especially since they just added infrared heaters overhead. So this brewery, cidery, and full-service restaurant, named after the goddess of chaos, Eris, can defy the winters of Chicago and keep everyone warm. So the story goes, Katie and her husband were both investors in Revolution Brewing, which is based in Chicago. And it is there that Katie first got to meet Michelle. And now I'll cue it to Katie Pisa and Michelle Foyk, who bring us into their story and how they built not just a cidery, but a brewery and a full-service restaurant. We first hear from Katie, who credits her husband for really pulling Michelle into the idea of Eris.
You know, he's trying to poach her.
He was.
Because his clients who were purchasing hops from him, that whenever they mentioned the struggles that they were having, it was usually in the operations management portion of their enterprise. And so, you know, this one with her background at Goose Island and Revolution was just the first name he thought of was someone who could help these clients. And after round and round of saying no, he said, well, what would your own project look like?
Then that is very true.
That is the birth of Eris.
Yeah. And at the time I was working for Virtue Cider. So I began my journey with cider, even though I've tried cider way in the past and have really enjoyed it, but the actual operations and being in a cider house or a cider farm was something new to me, but still very much on the same lines as of what craft beer was doing, because we didn't envision it as a winery. We envisioned it as a craft industry making cider. And so we followed the same path in marketing and sales for beer and good craft industry for that cider that we were doing. When Nunzio approached it, I was like, I'd really like just to have a cider pub. I think that would be what I'd like to work with. I'm tired of working in the beer industry. I think cider, watching what we were doing, I think cider is very innovative and we could do the same things that we do with craft beer and cider. And so then that was the direction I wanted to go. And what did they say back to us?
What did they?
The investors were like, well,
the idea of just a cidery was not going to get much traction in terms of financial backing from investors. The nice thing about putting the beer and cider together is that you can emphasize the commonalities and the pride that craft brewers and craft cider makers have in their work. Initially, we actually started doing a lot of blends as well, because a blend between beer and cider can sometimes be greater than the parts. Yeah. But the accessibility factor was key for Chicago, because at the time, this was prior to Northman. So in our, you know, in our heads, this wouldn't necessarily have taken so long to build out, but we would have been the first cider house in Chicago if we just didn't take so long.
Yeah. I mean, in 2013, cider was still the growing. In 2013, the growing industry was still beer, craft beer. And so when someone heard cider, they automatically went to all the negatives when someone hears cider, unfortunately, that doesn't know cider. So we fought, though, to make sure that we did cider and beer, because that was something that we both believed in, was cider.
Yeah.
So, and we enjoy cider. And
I can't even drink beer.
Right. So, I mean, how else was this going to work, you know?
I know Michelle can, so there you go. That helps. I mean, seriously.
It's my part. It's partners. We're there for each other. Exactly.
How far back does your relationship go?
We were in, my husband and I were investors in Revolution Brewing. And so I got to know Michelle through her work.
Yep.
I would see her at events. I would see her just in daily operations. But it wasn't until February of 2014 that we started working together. Like, you know, just, you no longer have a kitchen. This is a Paris planning area. And yeah, we just stuck it out together. And it was, the reason I keep mentioning February is that it really was 4 years until we opened in February 2018. So kind of a solid 4 years of planning, financing, purchasing, construction, you know, licensing. So
all
licensing happened earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot. I know I sent you a list of questions, but I'm going to kind of throw some out that I'm really curious about. And one is that business relationship between two co-owners. Your friends, you knew some of that. Was there something in the back of your mind that each of you were like a ticker tape going off saying, all right, I want to delve into something that's going to be a major investment, not only of your time, but monetarily? Was there something that really registered and said, this is like 1, 2, 3 that I want from my co-owner here?
I think at the time in 2014, there is no way I was going to be able to get anything in my head on paper. I was still fighting the idea of doing this. And when I met Katie's background was project management and organization. And, you know, we sat down together and we were able to create the business plan that we had for our building and our future and our future endeavor. And I think the more we sat together, the more she prodded into my brain and just like, and then also had opinions about it, you know, and also had, well, what if we did this? Because my world has been such a box in the brewery world and the pub that I sometimes don't think outside of the box. And so Katie, not being in the industry at the time, really was able to open the doors by saying, well, what if we did this? And sometimes it was easy to say, you crazy? No. But the more we got together, the more I realized that her opening these doors, even though they're not what I'm used to, actually help us create a better plan in the future. So I'm not sure if I can say like point, no, but I definitely know.
It kind of sounds smooth now, but that's because we've had 4 years to work on it. We have developed safe ways to communicate with each other because she has this, you know, she has this knowledge of the industry. She's got it locked down tight. And I might have to say something like, I'm like, okay, but from the guest perspective, or, but from someone who, you know, isn't running a reservation system, or, you know, just small things like that would be our way to kind of check in with each other to say like, hey, there's significant management like problems with what you are proposing, or, you know, hey, no one's going to understand this because we're not all cool kids. So just out there. It is a process. In terms of the balance of our responsibilities, we play to our strengths. I know that she is dynamite in front of people. She's great on camera. You want to just like, she want her to be representing the brand, talking to people, making them fall in love with cider. And me, I am very comfortable behind a computer. So there we go.
Well, you're doing great in front of the camera right now on Zoom. So
yeah, that's what I tell her all the time too.
Is there like a basic elevator pitch that you give to people from the get-go?
Aris is a brewery, a cider house, and a full-service restaurant all under one roof in Chicago. We're a modern cider production facility in that we do not have our own apple orchard here in the 60641, but we have a very fresh, we've got great relationships with suppliers who give us fresh raw juice and just lots of fermentation space downstairs.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
The name is also something that we point out every time because Aris is the goddess of chaos. So yeah, it fits us very well with the two ladies that run this place, the building itself being in a Masonic temple that was converted into a church and then converted into what Katie was just talking about, a brewery, a cider house, and a restaurant. So we get a lot of great fun in the idea of what our name is and who we are and just the things that come out of this place is, you know, chaotic in a good sense.
Yeah. Next, we go into the stress of managing such a massive build out. We begin by hearing from Michelle.
Katie and I were in every day to make sure that construction was kind of on a timeline, even though the contractor had a timeline and our architects had a timeline and
they were not the same timeline.
Did you have an initial estimation of when you were going to finish by and what was the difference there?
There are some parallel threads, things that you can make progress on at the same time, like swim lane type things. Mm-hmm. But then there are, you know, there are like milestones. They're like, you know, you get here and you cannot go any further. Yes. And so one of that was the bank. And so when you are getting your financing, you have to present your budget. You have to present like, here's my contractors. Here's how he thinks how much the project's going to cost. Cause you know, that's how much money we need. And here's how long he thinks it's going to take. Mm-hmm. So that initial estimate really was provided to us by our team, by our architecture team and our general contractor team, to the bank.
Yes.
We didn't have a lot of say in making it go faster or, you know, we would prefer that, you know, maybe you, you know, change it so that we can open in the summer instead of the dead of February. You know, I mean, we didn't really have a lot of say in that because also you can't start swinging hammers in Chicago without the construction permit. So with these things being like a big, dark vortex area where no one is going to give you an estimate that they'll be hold to, it would be difficult to speak to. And this one was really crafty. See if you can find an old interview with her where she tap dances about when we're going to open. Is she good?
February 2014 till we bought the building in July of 2015. So that's a year and a half that was planning, investments, banking, project budget.
We actually got the building just in cash. We got the building before the loan because it was taking us a while. We had a really fantastic female banker actually who looked at our plan and said, "Nice plan, excellent formatting, Katie Pizza, but I want you to raise, you know, an additional like basically practically 80% more than what we were planning to raise in private funds." And so that took a while. In the meantime, we've got this building under contract and it's subject to the following conditions. So it's like, we could get a lot of work done while the building is under contract because the seller was just so accommodating. They were really wonderful people, but we didn't have enough time to fund the whole project at the time of the building purchase. So we had to do that first. But then again, you're going to a bank, say, "Hey, we have a building now."
Yeah.
And this is our package now, you know, here's our building. Here's the remainder of the investor funds. Let's kick off this construction.
Yeah. Project. Which looks so much better than the bank.
Yeah.
Is there like a screen room in the building anywhere where you go in, or a hallway?
That's an excellent idea. We did, because this summer was particularly hard on our servers due to the pandemic and just the difference between having so much service out on the patio and some, I'll just say it, some verbal abuse from the staff. We converted the wine cooler to it's called the crying cooler.
Oh.
So people can go in there, they can scream, they can cry, you know, ask for it by name. And, you know, we can accommodate.
Oh.
There might be a couple of dents for me in that cooler. So
I'm sure there is. Taking the pandemic out of it for right now, which is, I know, a big piece of life right now, no doubt. What was your ballpark goal setting up Aeris in terms of production for both the beer and the cider? But let's start with the cider. Because you're sourcing juice in, you're making it in the basement. I imagine, are you pumping it into the basement? Is that it? Yeah. Truck comes, you pump it down into stainless? Yeah,
we had fresh pressed juice that we got from Peterson's Farm out in Shelby, Michigan. It was hard to judge the estimates because you would look at it saying it was going to be 50-50 because beer is more prominent than cider. But I think I knew cider would eventually become bigger. Just because it had to be. That was what I wanted. And I know that, like, I think between the two of us, we saw that too. But even when we were planning, it kind of planned for a 50-50 split.
Yeah.
Because now looking back at it, I would change quite a few things, you know, knowing. But
okay, well, let's go there.
Okay.
That I think that would be helpful for folks even. And I really don't know any other establishment in the country that is both a brewery and a cider house. So you've...
Sir? Yeah, there was one in Portland when I was at the Cider Con there. They did a bus tour, and there was a brew pub that also made cider. I don't remember the name of it, but I do remember the trip, practically every detail, because I'd never get out of the house, and that was a real treat for me.
But I think they don't always put brewery and cider house on the label, and that so there are a lot of breweries definitely adding cider into their complemented products, but not at the scale that you've done. So once again, you know, reinventing the wheel or creating the wheel.
Yeah.
So when you looked at that equipment for the cider, you were where is your production going? What did you see, Michelle? You thought that cider was going to come in. What did happen? Was that true?
It's true. Cider did come in and cider did start getting popular. I mean, for a long time it was 50-50 split. And then I think the idea of us really pushing the cider and creating new ciders on top of our beer helped out a lot. But what we're seeing now is that we are looking at the way we structured our brewery and cider house. So in the brewery, you have a 15 barrel system. And we have 15 barrel fermenters, which is completely fine and what we wanted to do. But we also added two 30 barrel fermenters, which means we would be doing a double batch of something. And that would be out, you know, we'd have a double batch of a 30 barrel fermenter. So then on our side of cider, we still had 5,000 gallons. So each of our tanks are 980 gallons, which is almost a 30 barrel also. So the 30 barrels on the cider side, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them. And then for the brewery, we had a 15, 15, 15, 230s. And one thing that we're seeing is that we're constantly filling the cider 30 barrels so much more than we're filling the 30 barrel brewery. For a pub, really looking at this, a 30 barrel probably wasn't needed because in a pub, you're always constantly making different types of styles. You know, in wholesale, yes, you want a 30 barrel because you are packaging 30 barrels. Yeah. But in a pub, we should have had 15. So I would have to say that one of our mistakes, and maybe it was because our vision was a little clouded because we're all used to being in a brewery.
Well, looking back, I think a lot of our decisions for the equipment and scale had to do with the physical constraints of the basement fermentation area and the serving tanks. You know, the areas that you'll see photographed on the website or when you visit us will be, you know, just really 1.5 floors, but we have a 3-story building. So we intended to be able to produce enough to service the whole building. We've got a potential for, and this is an additional construction project that has not started yet, but potentially a 200-person event space upstairs, which would be gorgeous. But we wanted to make sure that we could, you know, we kind of overscaled some of the equipment so that we'd be able to grow into the space. And her philosophy was, you know, how many breweries do you know of that have a small building and then within a couple of years they need to do all that work over again which is like great because it means they're successful, but it also means they've got to do all that work over again.
Yeah.
So if you get maybe a bigger space at first and you can, you know,
yeah. We didn't have the luxury of expanding.
Oh, I know.
Like, we had to fulfill before we were able to.
We can't get another large tank in here.
Yeah. It was opposite of what most people are doing, because when I remember the faces of cider makers and brewers walking through the space in Chicago during the cold CiderCon that year, and they're just like, you have a lot of tanks.
I know.
They're like, are you expecting all of these tanks to be used?
You're creating a monster.
Yeah.
No, but talk about planning ahead. I mean, that was brilliant, because I definitely know in the industry that is a number one I'm not going to say it's a mistake, but it's a novice approach to not build in for expansion. So it sounds like you've really set yourself up quite well 5-10 years down the line. I mean, that's so unusual for me to hear, because I constantly interview new brewers all the time when I'm writing about beer, and they're starting nano and they go to, you know, micro, you know, it's amazing. So expansion was built into your business model from the get-go. Which
yes.
is really, I mean, that's the thing in these interviews on this subject for building a cidery. It's the number one thing for folks. Build that in and go like sometimes 3 times larger than what you're planning.
You had asked 2 questions. One was, you know, what were you very happy with when you first started that you couldn't live without? Which piece of equipment? And I would said the crosswell filter, because that was our way of making sure that cider wasn't going to re-ferment. I mean, it was this amazing piece of...
Actually, this is intriguing, because this is still how I would answer that same question. How has the crossflow filter fallen out of favor?
Yeah, the crossflow has fallen out of favor because it's not as fast as what we needed to do when it comes to our canning products, when it comes to doing more than 15 barrels at a time. So when we are doing a packaging run of 980 gallons, the crossflow takes a long time. And honestly, I don't know if there's anything else out there that would be faster or better at this point, but it has changed our processes.
No one knew
in 3 years we're going to be switching our plan into cans right off the bat. We were under the impression we were going to be working on that second floor to create a event space, you know, and now we are canning. So,
Yeah. And that's due to the pandemic, really, right? Pushing that out. Anything that you wish you knew then that you know now, other than outside of the equipment? I mean, it'd be nice if we were prepared for COVID, but that's outside of that.
I think year two, I wish I would have known that I was way too much of a micromanager. There's a big difference being an operations manager your entire life and then becoming an owner and trying to manage at the same time. So that would be my thing that I now look back at and see that, you know, I can't put a Band-Aid on everything, and that micromanaging is what it is, putting a Band-Aid on something rather than fixing it all the way through. So
we're being more cognizant of the need for a balance between planning and operating. And I think that the balance in the first several years was so heavily on operations that, you know, we had a plan, you know, it was and it was collecting dust in a file.
Yeah.
We weren't working towards making those things happen. And we are more aware of that right now and dedicating time every week. We're
really?
Both first-time owners.
Yeah, so. And that's huge. You took on becoming a restaurateur, becoming a brewer, and becoming a cider maker. And right now, Katie's just put a palm to her forehead and we're all kind of laughing at that. But I mean, that is freaking huge. Let's go to any tips for folks looking to get into perhaps a model like you have or just into the industry overall that you might recommend?
I'd say first and foremost, find an architect that you like and vet them, and definitely talk to a couple of people that you know regarding contracting. Because I think that both those things together, there has to be a good relationship, and there are going to be changes along the way, and you really have to know how to work within those changes. So I think the starting of the business itself is very, very important compared to when you're filing in operations.
Very good.
I would just say, I mean, it's almost kind of the opposite. Plan to fail. You're going to mess up. Okay. Just, you're going to mess up, but you're going to learn. So maybe have a couple phases of your project into maybe manageable segments. Our first segment was gigantic. Our second segment, things that we're looking at or doing are much more like manageable of scale, but we're a hell of a lot smarter because we learn things. You don't even know what you need to learn.
Yeah. You don't even know what you need to learn.
Don't know what you need to learn. You know,
I mean, we talk about,
because there's a lot of combined knowledge between these two heads and we still learned more. It's amazing. That's how knowledge and experience works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on. Right on. How many taps do you have there in the pub?
Oh, we have 18 taps.
And how many are beer and how many are cider?
8 ciders right now and
6 beers?
Yes.
6 beers. And do you ever have guests taps for anybody?
Mm-hmm.
We do. For both cider and beer. Okay.
Yes, we have 3 guest taps for cider and 3 guest taps for beer.
Oh my goodness, Mr. Quince, is that who I think it is laughing there in the background?
Yes, that was Eris.
Well, I think she's probably just as impressed as I am in all of Ciderville with both Michelle Foyk and Katie Pisa of Eris Brewery and Cider House. But just make sure that, you know, we kind of shuffle her out of the Cider House and she doesn't hang out too much with the wild yeast there, okay?
Too late.
Oh no, Medlars. Perry Pear, can you open up the barn door and maybe bring Eris out to the orchard, perhaps? Come this way, goddess. Thanks, Perry Pear.
We're on it, Rhea.
Phew, Mr. Quince, that was a close one.
Let's close this episode out, Rhea.
Good idea, Mr. Quince. Let's do it. A big tip of the glass to both Katie Pisa and Michelle Foyk, the owners of Eris Brewery and Cider House, based in Chicago. Go to the show notes for this here episode 260 at ciderchat.com, and you'll be able to see photos of the tanks being moved into the building during the build-out. And you also see one particular photo of a finishing touch at this site that really addresses the needs for the patrons. Once again, just go to ciderchat.com and look for episode 260, Eris Brewery and Cider House, Building a Cidery, Part 6. And with that, I leave you here, because I know Eris is out in the orchard right now with Perry Pear and the Medlars, and Mr. Quince and I need to get out there, like, now. This is Rhea Wincoller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
We like cider. We like palms. We love orchards and having fun. There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is. There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider. We like palms, we like orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason. There is a reason why we do it like this. Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason.
We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes we do.
We like palms.
Oh yes we do.
We love orchards, having some fun. There is a reason. There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum. Ba-da-da-dum.
We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms.
Oh yes we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
Yeehaw!